Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of T1 Talks. This is a podcast where we aim to share our experiences living with type 1 diabetes to build a sense of community for diabetics, both type 1 and 2. We want to dispel any myths about what it means to be a type 1 and increase diabetic awareness through our stories. I'm Gianna, a type 1 diabetic of 14 years and a recent graduate of the College of New Jersey.
And I'm Victoria. I'm a medical student from Saskatchewan, Canada, and I was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in March of this year.
And today we're going to be answering the most Googled questions about diabetes. I'm super excited for this episode. It's been one I've been wanting to do for a while. And this episode is actually inspired by a YouTube channel called Wired. And if you've heard of them, you've probably seen their videos called Celebrities Answer the Web's Most Searched Questions, where they'll bring on a celebrity, they're given a list of the most Googled questions about them, and they answer them. So we kind of thought it would be fun to look up the most Googled questions about diabetes or diabetics in general, and just maybe debunk some myths in the process, hopefully.
I think this is such a fun episode. It's interesting to see sort of what people look for most or what they're interested in. And I do have to add a disclaimer that I have never seen Wired. So this was totally just Gianna's brilliant idea for this episode. And we did come up with about 30 questions that people sort of came up with most, and we're hoping to answer them all through this episode.
I'm imagining this is going to be similar to my favorite episode we've done so far, which was episode 7, where we just spent the whole time debunking diabetic myths. But I think this one will be a lot more casual, and we're going to see how many we can get through. We do have a lot. We'll just go around our normal time and see where we end up. Anyways, to kick us off, and one question that was asked in every way possible was, what is diabetes? We saw questions asking, what is type 1 diabetes? What is type 2 diabetes? What is diabetes mellitus, diabetes insipidus, and so on? So we're going to do our best to break down all the different types for you. But before we get into that, I should probably mention that even though I've had diabetes for as long as I have, I saw these questions and I had absolutely no idea what diabetes mellitus was. And I'm only admitting this to stress the point that just because I've grown up with diabetes or just because I've lived with this condition for X amount of years doesn't mean that I have all the answers, and that as diabetics, you're bound to learn new things about your condition all the time. So don't be afraid to ask questions because you think you should know something. I know it can be easy to feel that way, but there's so much information out there, so just don't feel discouraged.
Hopefully this episode is educational for everybody, but I do just have to point out that it's not uncommon for people, especially patients, to not understand fully what their conditions are and to not know all the terminology. And so I think diabetes specifically, like when we think of diabetes, we think of what we would call sugar diabetes, which is diabetes mellitus. And we'll get into that more. But I think that people don't understand that there's even different qualifiers for diabetes. A lot of the listeners now are like, what the heck is diabetes insipidus? I think it's pretty normal that you don't know the official medical terminology for your condition, which is fair.
Yeah, I don't know if I was just too young to remember hearing about it, if I just genuinely never heard of it, but yeah. So diabetes generally. What is diabetes? To put it kind of simply, it's a condition where your blood glucose levels are higher than someone without diabetes because your body can't produce or won't respond to insulin hormones. So the way I think about it a lot is your body is consistently attacking itself.
Sounds fun, right?
Obviously it's fun. Any disease is just a joyous time. I mean, there might be fun aspects. I like my pretty tapes that I get to put on my Dexcom, at least.
Okay, I'll give you that. The stickers are fun. But when you break it down to just the general description, you have to admit it sounds like a nightmare, doesn't it?
It really, I mean, mostly is a nightmare, if I'm honest, but you live with it. So to answer your question, or like the question of what is diabetes, there's technically two types of diabetes. One is diabetes mellitus, which is the more common kind of diabetes and definitely the more sort of well-known diabetes. And when you translate the words back to their original meanings, it means sweet siphon.
Interesting.
Gianna, to your point, I didn't know this. I had to look it up when we started making this episode. And I thought it was super interesting because I knew mellitus meant sweet, but I didn't know that diabetes meant siphon. And I think it's really funny because siphon is something that filters through and you just siphon it out. You're just pouring water out. And that's basically what you do in diabetes is you just pee all the time.
I can vouch for that.
Anyways, what distinguishes diabetes insipidus, which you mentioned, from diabetes mellitus is that diabetes mellitus is sort of the sweet part. So it means sweet. And essentially what it means is that your urine is sweet. So the siphon part of it means that you're just peeing a lot. And then mellitus means that it is sweet. And so as physicians, thank goodness that I'm becoming a doctor now, but doctors actually used to diagnose diabetes by tasting people's urine to see how sweet it was.
That might be the most absurd thing I've ever heard. Just imagine that today you walk into the doctor's office and they tell you that they're going to be drinking your urine to see how sweet it is.
But this sort of is what distinguishes it from diabetes insipidus, which again is sort of a form of diabetes, but it's just like where you're peeing out water. Your sugars are normal. Your urine isn't sweet. You're just losing water. And obviously that isn't what we're going to focus on for this episode since we're both type 1 diabetics. So speaking of all of that, I think that the next question that came up a ton is what on earth is type 1 diabetes? In terms of type 1, it's obviously the form both Gianna and I have, and it's the more rare form. And so like 5 to 10% of the diabetic population have type 1 diabetes versus type 2.
Yeah, and so really at its core, type 1 diabetes is an insulin production problem. So you were born with the predisposition and certain events throughout your life are going to bring out your diabetes. An example that Victoria actually shared with me and that I found super helpful was thinking about an elementary school when one child in your class got sick with something like the common cold, it spreads throughout the class quickly and maybe 99% of the children come out just fine. But for one student, it triggers that predisposition and then your type 1 becomes discovered.
Exactly. So basically what you're saying is just that we're all sort of born how we're born. And then it just takes something in our environment or sometimes a lot of things in our environment to trigger the disease from coming up. And in type 1, I think that typically compared to type 2, we're younger in our age when we're diagnosed. And that's because it takes fewer environmental triggers before we're diagnosed. In adult speak, I like to think of it as a shot glass. So you fill up your shot glass so much just from your genetics. I like to think about the difference between you and I, Gianna, because I think it's just so interesting that you were diagnosed so young compared to me. I was diagnosed sort of late for type 1 diabetes at 29. And I think about how like our shot glasses were just inherently filled to different levels when we were born and yours was almost full. And so it didn't take too many years before yours overflowed and you became type 1. Versus mine, it took a lot more triggers before I became type 1 diabetic.
You know, I actually really like that. I feel like you have a really great way, Victoria, of explaining things that are super complicated in an easy and understandable way. So that's something that I really appreciate. Thank you. I will say, I think a lot of these questions are coming from people who are either newly diagnosed with diabetes or don't have diabetes and are trying to learn more about it. And I think that comes from the fact that nobody really knows what diabetes actually is. They just hear about the generic stereotypes like the, oh, I'm going to eat this giant dessert, that equals diabetes thing that everyone likes to talk about.
Absolutely. And I think that that stereotype comes from, I mean, we're going to talk about this quite a bit in this episode, but just sort of the idea that type 2 diabetes is totally preventable. And then it's sort of like type 1 gets lumped into that. But again, I would argue that type 2 diabetes probably isn't totally preventable because it's the same idea where you have this shot glass that's as full as it's going to be when you're born. And then it just takes these different environmental triggers. But I think it's also just this sort of misunderstanding of the problem in type 1 versus type 2. Like in type 1, like you said, it's an insulin production problem. So our bodies no longer produce enough insulin to keep our sugars level. Whereas type 2 diabetes specifically is actually an insulin resistance problem. So that means that instead of in type 1, where our pancreases just aren't producing insulin, in type 2 diabetes, the pancreas is working overtime because it's working just fine, but the body's cells aren't responding how they should. So when there's insulin in the system, the cells should take up the insulin and let sugar into the cells. That's insulin's job. It's like a lock and a key. And so insulin is the key to let sugar into the cells. And so if the cells aren't listening to the insulin, then it just keeps sort of building up in the system. And your pancreas just creates more and more and more insulin to really have no effect on the ultimate goal, which is to get sugar into your cells.
Yeah, and I think type 2 is the type that most people think about when hearing the word diabetes, probably because it's the most common type. But again, like bringing it back to those stereotypes, I think that's something that type 2s are forced to face a lot of the time. And I think that type 2 is often looked at as the easier type of diabetes. And because of that, people don't realize that they can face the same complications that we as type 1s can if they don't take care of their diabetes. Their pancreas is still not producing the right amount of insulin for them. They still have to do that for themselves. And sure, it may be managed in a different way than type 1 diabetes, but that doesn't make it less severe.
I love that you mentioned that. And it's so true. That's the whole reason that I know we talk about it a lot, but that's the whole reason why sort of treating your type 2 diabetes earlier and faster is so beneficial, because you essentially just avoid becoming a type 1 diabetic where you have to do the whole, like, a lot of type 2 diabetics don't need to check their sugars every day. They don't need to use insulin. Some don't even need to take oral medications. It really just depends on sort of how progressed your type 2 diabetes is. Whereas type 1 diabetes is way more of just like an acute onset. It comes quickly and it hits hard and you're just done. And I think that that's sort of the biggest difference between type 1 and type 2, is that when you start developing type 2 diabetes, there's a chance to go back and do things that will help your pancreas function better. Whereas in type 1 diabetes, it's sort of already set in stone. Your pancreas is dying. It's not going to produce insulin anymore, and you just have to move forward. But I do think it's important to talk about how type 2 diabetes develops, because it is much more, it's both more genetic and more environmentally predetermined. Now, I really want to say my little disclaimer here is that I believe it's only more predetermined by genetics and environment, because it takes up 95-ish% of the population of diabetics. So that means that most of the research we've done on diabetes has been done on type 2 diabetes. And so it's mostly just a numbers game, where like we've just had the opportunity to do more research on type 2, and so we have more clear relationships. Regardless, I think it's good to understand that type 2 diabetes is more linked to environment. So when people talk about type 2 diabetes, there's a lot of actually bad connotations around it that are around sort of people being overweight or eating unhealthily or drinking lots of sugary beverages or living a sedentary lifestyle. All of these things that we can sort of blame people for. But I just have to reiterate that it's the exact same thing as the shot glass metaphor I gave earlier, where this, like, two people with different genetics can do the exact same thing in their life, and one will end up with diabetes type 2 and the other will not. And that's purely because there's such a genetic influence that it's hard to know whether you would or wouldn't develop type 2 diabetes until you've actually developed it.
I'll throw in there, the first thing I usually get when I tell people I have diabetes is that at least you don't have type 2, which, can you imagine hearing that as a type 2 diabetic all the time? And just, I feel stressed out knowing I have to deal with this the rest of my life. But if I knew I had to put in all this work and effort every day, and then maybe I can turn it around, but maybe I can't, that just sounds incredibly overwhelming.
I definitely have to agree. It was a relief for me to be able to tell people I'm type 1 diabetic and not type 2. And it's for exactly that reason. It's not that type 2 diabetes is a worse condition. It's just that it comes with a lot more social connotations.
Diabetes is already something that's so self-managing on its own. We don't need to hear anyone else's judgment, because trust me, we're already judging ourselves. But I think when it comes down to comparing type 1 and type 2 and saying, this is better and this is worse, they're two different things. You don't need to make any comparisons between them at all.
I totally agree. I'm on psychiatry right now for my clinical rotation. And something I hear a lot from psychiatrists is a comparison between a mental illness and a physical illness. And I feel exactly the same way. Is it's like these patients are suffering from whatever condition they're suffering from. There's really no point in comparing one condition to another. Whether I have type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, if I'm in hospital because it's not being managed, it's not being managed. Versus if I'm doing well in the community and, you know, working and feeling well, it's good. So it's not the condition. It's really just about how we can manage it and how supported we are, I think, ultimately by our doctors and people in our lives. Sort of speaking to this whole point, and something that I thought was a funny sort of spin-off, is diabetes contagious? Obviously, right now we're dealing with a lot of contagious things in the media, specifically COVID and sort of the implications of that with flu season, which I know in Saskatchewan we're having, and in Canada in general, we're having a pretty big uptick in sort of the number of COVID cases. But thankfully, diabetes is decidedly not contagious. So don't worry about that.
I'm really curious as to who's asking these questions. Like, I'm curious, is it people with diabetes, maybe newly diagnosed? Is it people that just met a diabetic and they want to know if they can catch diabetes? I've never, in all my years of being diabetic, been asked if my diabetes is contagious. So I was kind of shocked to see that this was one of the most asked questions.
Can totally see that. And I think it's good that you haven't been. The only time I've run into problems is sometimes when I'm at work and I'm like, oh, I'm not feeling well because my sugar's high or whatever. People automatically think it's COVID and they're like, oh no, are you sick? And I'm like, no.
I can believe that. The next question we found was, is diabetes genetic?
This is such a good question. And I do feel like we've sort of already touched on this, but I think the answer just has to be sort of that it's a combination between our genes and our environment. So like I was saying with the shot glasses, like the genes sort of predetermine how full your shot glass is, and then your environment determines the rest.
It's kind of funny because I used to go around telling everyone that the way to tell type 1 diabetes apart from type 2 diabetes is that type 1 is the genetic kind and that you need to have had it passed down by a family member. And I think that just came from the idea of me getting it passed down from my dad, which turns out to be a rare situation. It's surprising to me that type 2 is actually the much more common type for having genetic links.
And actually, I was surprised by learning that fact as well, because you do sort of assume that type 1 is more genetic. I think only because we hear about how you can prevent type 2 diabetes with lifestyle changes and good diet. But actually, type 2 diabetes runs in families. You can see it, and it's way more genetic. Versus for me, I don't have any type 1 diabetics in my family, and I still developed type 1.
I think this leads well into the next question we saw, which was, should 2 diabetics have kids? Now, obviously, this is a really personal question. It's going to be different for every different individual diabetic, every diabetic couple, but I'm going to go ahead and give my unsolicited opinion anyway and say that diabetes is manageable. And if you get to a point where you and your partner, who in this situation is also diabetic, are having a child together, I just don't think that you should let your fear of having a child with diabetes stop you. I totally get it. It sucks. You don't want to put that on someone else. But at the same time, as someone who has type 1 because of her dad, I've never thought of it as a situation where I'm sitting there blaming him. And if anything, I appreciate the fact that he gets bits and pieces of how I'm feeling, or that if I run out of insulin, I know I can use his in an emergency. I feel like I've always found it more comforting than anything.
I love your perspective on this. I think it's the most valuable perspective we could hear for this question, which is the perspective of a type 1 diabetic who you can clearly link who it came from in your family. And I don't think it's a place for blame. I think that deciding to have kids is a personal decision. And I don't think that your diabetes should determine how you make that decision.
No, ultimately the choice is between you and your partner, but you're never going to know how that child's going to feel until you have them. And you're never going to know how it's going to affect you that they potentially have diabetes until it happens. But it's something you can work through, and it's something that you might be able to guide them through. I wouldn't let that be something that limits you if that's something you really want.
And I do have to add, it isn't super common, and I should have looked up the numbers before this, but I didn't. But it's not super common common to actually pass on diabetes to your kids, even if there's two of you. I think that the chance is still less than like 40% that you'll pass it on.
I do have two siblings and neither of them have diabetes, so...
Winning!
And with that, I'll move on to our next question, which was, is diabetes curable? Curable? No. Manageable? Yes. I found this article recently on Beyond Type 1 that said, I think it was less than 1/3 of diabetics have their sugar levels in their goal range consistently. This made me feel a little bit better. I don't know about anyone else, but I am rarely in range. And I can tell you firsthand that although diabetes is quote unquote manageable, it takes so much work to manage it and to manage it well. Every single day is just another challenge to start over and try to keep your sugars where they're supposed to be for the entire day.
Exactly. I think that that's super important. Diabetes definitely isn't curable, but it is manageable. And well-managed diabetes, if you have a CGM, is 70% in range. And so I think that that's always really good to hold on to because it isn't perfection. It's 70% in range, and that still can feel like perfection. But I think that just trying to make small goals and improvements can be really helpful. So say you're at 35% in range, just try to get it up to maybe 38%. So I think that just like attainable goals when you're trying to manage is really important. I personally was surprised and not surprised, which is sad, but that less than 1/3 of patients have it managed. But I can see why that's the case. It is a super difficult condition to manage, especially type 1, whereas like type 2 diabetes is also difficult to manage, but in such a different way. And that's like we were saying before, is because it is in theory reversible. Which brings us to our next question that I'm going to dive right into, which comes up, which is diabetes reversible?
Good question.
I think it's important to talk about the fact that type 1 is absolutely not reversible. There's just no way. Type 2 diabetes can be reversible. Some people would argue that it is reversible, but I would not. And that's just because of those environmental factors and the fact that your pancreas is still working to produce insulin. So it hasn't totally given up. Versus in type 1, it's sort of just done. There's no going back. Type 2 can reverse. But it's important for me to say that all diabetics, type 1 and type 2, can decrease their insulin requirements by eating well and exercising. And for type 2 diabetes, that means that maybe you don't need to take oral medications either. Now, as we all know, eating well and exercising is easier said than done. And I think it's good to have healthy as a goal for anyone. But I think that we need to sort of consider all aspects of our health when we think about what healthy means. And mostly what I mean by this is as a type 1 diabetic, I could optimize my diabetic management by tracking everything I ate, every drop of insulin I gave myself, any activity that I did throughout the day, right? Like there's 100 things that I could track. And I have to tell you, I track none of them except for how much insulin I give myself. And that's only in my pump and it disappears after 30 days. I'm not really tracking anything long term. And that's because it's better for me. It's better for my mental health. If I start tracking everything, I go downhill quickly. And so I think that it's good to remember that your diabetic management is one piece of a really big puzzle that includes your entire life. So healthy is a good goal to have, whether you're type 1 or type 2. But again, when you're thinking about what healthy means, it's not just about your diabetes. It actually needs to consider every single aspect of our life and of our health.
And I think that obsession with figuring out what healthy is for a diabetic is what led to this next question we saw, which was, what do diabetics eat? And this question was another one with a bunch of smaller pieces. I saw, can diabetics eat potatoes, honey, fruits, beer, popcorn, etc.? And I think it's really common when first diagnosed with diabetes or being someone without diabetes to think that diabetics can't eat this or that. In reality, we can really eat whatever we choose. We just have to compensate for that with insulin. And as my endocrinologists love to tell me, everything is about moderation.
Exactly. And I think that that's a really important point. For me being newly diagnosed, I think it's a little different. Obviously for you, like you sort of have figured out with your endocrinologist, your insulin ratios and all of that. But for me, when I was first diagnosed, I actually had to cut a lot of things out because my initial goal was good sugar control. And this obviously isn't everyone's goal, but me being me, that was just what I needed to focus on. Just maintaining really good control of my sugars and then figuring out my life around that, which isn't how everyone approaches it. And that's fair. We're all unique. But honestly, now that I'm 7 months in, I definitely restricted things in the beginning so that I could maintain that control. But since then, I've been able to sort of add more things in and have just good learning opportunities where I maybe make a mistake or whatever. And I can say that I can order anything I really like, not anything, but anything I like from a restaurant or the hospital cafeteria, which is obviously important, pretty comfortably. And that's not the way I felt at the beginning. So at the beginning, I was really restricted. I wouldn't try anything new. I definitely wouldn't have anything that I thought would be hard to dose for, like tater tots or like a salad, you know, things that I wasn't sure about. But now I feel like I can sort of just order what, I mean, in the hospital cafeteria is a great example because they serve two meals. That's all you get to choose from. And so it's like, if I'm not eating one of those two meals, I don't eat. So I have to be flexible. And with that, it doesn't mean that I don't make a lot of mistakes when I'm dosing. But I think what I've developed over time is just a confidence that I'll dose reasonably well enough that I can compensate. So like I can treat any lows or highs that come up. And then on any days where I can't, which I think come up if I have an exam or if I have sort of a stressful work thing going on, I also feel good just eating familiar carbs that I know how to count that I've had lots of times. So it's just sort of a balance. But I would also stress that we can eat anything we want. It's just for the newly diagnosed diabetic, I think that there's some room for figuring out what works and what doesn't and giving yourself some time to bring all the range of foods that you once loved back into your life. But I think it's important to remember that you will bring them back.
I will say that foods like pastas, I tend to stay away from these days just because my insulin, no matter how much I take, is never really able to keep up with that. And I always end up with high sugars afterwards. And I try to avoid that. So pastas are a once in a while thing for me.
Totally. And I think that that's pretty similar to how somebody with a gluten sensitivity might choose to only have pasta like once every 3 months or whatever, right? Like, I think that what works for us personally is always super important. For me, I don't find pasta to be as bad as I find like potatoes. For me, are just killer. Speaking of potatoes, the next question is, what do diabetics eat for breakfast? And I'm just gonna say that I don't eat breakfast really ever. When I was first diagnosed, I was on a really rigid routine where I was forcing myself to have smoothies and things like that. But like, no breakfast for me. I have two lattes on a good morning where I wake up early enough to down them and then go to work. And then I eat lunch.
See, I love breakfast. Breakfast foods are my favorite. I will always try to make time for breakfast because it's what gives me energy to get through the rest of my day. But I can relate to feeling like I'm so busy, I don't have time for breakfast. And sometimes before work or school, definitely have skipped a meal before.
Totally.
And just a tip for anyone who wakes up with high blood sugars a lot, eggs are the perfect breakfast food for someone with high blood sugar.
I love it. Eggs are all protein, really like no carbs. So in theory, you shouldn't have to dose for them. Although I know that some people do dose for protein because it does eventually get broken down into carbs, but it's just so different. I'm sure we'll get into this, but I have trouble eating when my sugars are high. I try to get them down before I eat.
I'm already an angry person when my sugars are high, but I am the worst when it comes to this. I feel like I'm always the most hungry when I can't eat because my sugars are so high. I'll try to hold off as long as I can, but sometimes I just give in and eat anyway. Don't do that.
Oh, for sure. I have to say, even before I was diagnosed diabetic, I've never eaten breakfast, even as a kid. It's just not my personal choice. I can totally see people needing that food in the morning. Everyone does. Just some of us who are anti-breakfast eaters, I guess, don't.
Fair enough. But I think the next question, what do diabetics drink, is something that we can all come together on and say, diet everything. Diet Coke and Diet Snapple are my two personal weaknesses.
Diet Coke is what I live on, so.
I run on it. Diet Coke all the time. I didn't really know what this question was referring to, so I also just threw in there that if my sugar is high, water is what we're drinking all the time. My bed's surrounded by water bottles. If you're talking about alcohol, I tend to stick to fruity drinks just because they're delicious, but it also kind of sucks because they can destroy your sugar levels really quickly. Diet Coke and rum is a good one of mine, and it actually doesn't affect my sugars too much. So that's what I like, because I don't have to stay super on top of my sugars when I'm drinking it, compared to those fruity drinks I was talking about, where I'm constantly giving myself more and more insulin.
I love that. Diet Coke and rum for me is way too sweet, but oh. I appreciate that people like it. I mean, like, obviously, I'm a medical student. I live on coffee. I don't know who doesn't. And now that I'm diabetic, I also drink way too much juice, which I have to say is not my favorite, but it's what I use to treat my lows more than half the time, just because I find it super convenient. I can throw a juice box in my fanny pack, or I can have one on my nightstand, and it's great. I also drink a lot of Diet Coke. If I'm not drinking coffee, I'm drinking Diet Coke, and obviously water, you know, because hydration is good. But other than that, I also obviously drink alcohol. And like, my choices are usually low carb beer or wine, just because they do have less carbs than other drinks. And then I also just have this love for Caesars. I only had my first Caesar, I want to say maybe a year or two ago, and I just fell in love with them. They're so delicious, and I'm really grateful that they're something I can still drink, even though now I'm diabetic, because none of them spike my sugars, nor do they cause a big drop, both of which, like I know you were alluding to, Gianna, can both happen. So you can have this spike, or you can have this crazy drop when you drink alcohol. And I think that it's important to be safe when we're drinking alcohol. So obviously, like you were saying, snacking lots, making sure you're prepared, even having somebody sort of on call watching your Dexcom who isn't drinking, all things like that can help when you're drinking. But for me, I have to admit that I find quite a few limits on what I can drink, not alcohol-wise, but just in general, because I find when I drink carbs, they hit me really, really fast. So obviously, like, a bottle of Coke is out of the question, regular Coke with sugar, but also things like smoothies or like fruit juice, all of those things I would have to avoid. Sugar in my coffee is something that I have to think hard about. So like, it's not that it's not doable, it's just that it's harder to manage, obviously, as a diabetic. And I know that people get a lot of flack for being annoying in restaurants, but I would definitely double check that I get a diet beverage instead of a sugary beverage. Just because, like, if I get a sugary Coke, it's gonna ruin my day.
Ugh, I always feel so annoying when I have to check with someone three times and be like, are you sure this is diet? I don't know. It doesn't taste like diet. You didn't mark it as diet. But I'm only doing it for my safety, because if I was to drink a regular soda, my sugars would shoot up, especially if I didn't know I was drinking that and didn't take any insulin for it.
Yeah, it's hard to balance the social norms with just like your own physical health needs. It's like, I'm not doing this for any reason other than it might kill me.
Exactly. I used to work as a server, and I would have people apologize to me all the time because they had to ask for certain accommodations with like their gluten allergies or their seafood allergies, whatever it was. And I always tried to stress to them and to everyone I meet, you should not have to apologize for these things. You didn't ask for them.
And the other thing I think that's important to remember from the server's point of view or from the restaurant's point of view is that it's really that person is advocating for themselves, because as humans, we all make mistakes. And so it's super easy to just automatically push the regular Coke button instead of the Diet Coke button, versus the mistake of actually drinking that drink has a much bigger impact on me than not. I think that that's actually a pretty good segue into our next question, which is, what do diabetics need to avoid? And so I have to say, in my opinion, there's nothing that diabetics absolutely need to avoid, as long as I leave out diabetic burnout. I think that diabetic burnout is probably one of the biggest things that we need to avoid as diabetics, but a big part of that is just sort of looking after ourselves in other ways. And part of that is just like realizing that if we dose correctly, we can eat and do anything we want to. But the reality is that this is easier said than done. And so it's important to remember that when you're going through this process of eating and doing anything you want, you're going to run into learning opportunities and or like problems along the way that you can just sort of learn from and move on and just try to keep getting better at it is what I would say.
I am 100% with you on that. Diabetic burnout is something that I've experienced. It's something that I think you've experienced already. And it's something that we really need to start helping diabetics deal with early on, which kind of brings me to something that I would say diabetics need to avoid, and that's establishing crappy habits early on. I always think back on when I was first diagnosed with diabetes and those first couple of years, and I just wish I had tried a little harder to carb count and track patterns early on, because I know for me at least, it was something that I thought I could brush over and ignore and that I'd be fine not dealing with. But seeing how many other aspects of my life it affected and how little effort I put into trying to work on it, it just sucks, because I think I could have saved myself a lot more of the work that I have to put in now to make up for it. And I didn't have the kind of mindset that I wish I did before. I didn't have the kind of, I need to try to take care of this as best I can mindset that I have now.
For sure. I think that developing good habits early on is always recommended. As a counter or just like a different perspective, I feel like in order for me to avoid my own self-judgment, I avoid high sugars. And that actually leads to sort of a lot of restriction, a lot of preoccupation with my sugars, checking and rechecking, things like that. So I'm not advocating for this. I think that it's important to avoid setting these sort of strict restrictions on yourself. So like for me right now, I still avoid really highly processed carbs, and I definitely avoid eating when my sugars are too quote unquote high, which for me means if I'm above 8, I won't eat, which is a little ridiculous. And I understand that. And so I think that the most important thing to realize is that it's all about your average and the habits that you're building and the changes that you're making, and not about the ultimate goal. Because I think that my sugar control is excellent, but that's at a sacrifice for my mental health, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does make sense. I think it's something that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of self-management, like I say, with everything. This is a problem that I don't think many people think about when thinking about diabetes, but I think it's something that's extremely important. I'm going to keep us moving on to our next question, which was, what do diabetics need? And my answer to this is more people that understand how a chronic condition works. Part of the reason that I wanted to do this podcast was because I really want people to understand that just because I can do things doesn't mean I should. And if you're listening to this as a non-diabetic, imagine yourself having a cold and you feel like trash, but you have to go to work. So you go anyway, you push through the shift, and you get it done. But you leave feeling awful, you feel drained, but you put on a happy face while you're there and you push through and you keep going to the next day because you have life to do. Now multiply that garbage feeling by 1,000. Think about that cold as something you're carrying through your life, and that's what we're going through every single day. And it just sucks because people don't seem to understand that when it comes to invisible conditions. And I think it leads to people living with conditions like diabetes to push themselves way too far all the time.
Exactly. And that kind of pushing yourself causes burnout. And I would totally agree. All we need as diabetics is just support. We need support from our family, from our friends, from our coworkers, from our classmates, from the community members, from society, everybody. We need people to, instead of judging the condition, we need people to ask, what can they do to help? And ultimately, I think just knowing what your role is as a support person is huge. And then just giving us some leeway when we need an extra couple seconds to finish a juice box or go check our sugars or give some insulin, or if we need to take an afternoon off because we've been high all day, whatever the reason, I think that we just need that support and understanding.
Definitely. A core support system is so important. I will preach it to the end. Finding that online community for diabetics was really what started motivating me to take care of myself. And it's what inspired me to start really caring about my mental well-being and physical well-being as a diabetic. It'll just help you feel less alone, I think.
Exactly. Speaking of taking care of yourself, the next question is, what do diabetics take?
I don't even know what this question means.
I know. Literally, I didn't either. I assumed that it is a medication question, so that's how I'm answering it. But you'll see, I do give it some leeway. Anyways, in terms of medication, I think anyone who has insulin production problems, which are anyone with type 1 diabetes and then some type 2 diabetics, as well as if you have gestational diabetes, you would take it too. So insulin, we just give insulin to anyone who has diabetes who can't produce enough insulin. But for insulin resistance, which again is the hallmark of type 2 diabetes, we have actually a lot of oral medications or pills that people can take. And often type 2 diabetics can go years or forever with just making lifestyle changes and maybe taking one or two pills a day. A lot of them never end up needing insulin. I just have to leave the caveat now that if you're a type 2 diabetic who doesn't need to take insulin and can manage things with lifestyle changes, that's great. And you can sort of end things there and just take normal life things with you. But if you're on insulin, if you're a type 1 diabetic, you actually have to take a whole lot of other things every day. So these things are like when I leave the house or when I'm around, I need to have my glucometer with me. I need strips. I need lancets. I need my insulin. I need needles. I need alcohol swabs. I need my Dexcom supplies. I need my pump supplies. I need supplies for if I go low, so like juice and snacks. And I have to have these things with me basically 100% of the time. I was just recently asked by one of my physician teachers, he's like, oh, do you ever take your backpack off? And I'm like, no, it literally has my life in it. It has everything I need. So we definitely take, quote unquote, take a lot of things with us.
Oh yeah, there is so much I have to take every day when I go out because of my diabetes. So I take insulin, I take pods, I take sensors, I take snacks. And on top of those, I used to have to take a pill every day. There's just so much I need to remember and so much that people don't realize that I need to have with me. For example, my cell phone that reads me my blood sugar levels. I don't use a receiver, so I need that charged at all times and with me. I'm definitely carrying a lot more on me that's necessary to keep me alive than the average person.
It's like when I show my fanny pack, the biggest thing in my fanny pack is like, it fits a juice box. And everyone's like, why do you need a juice box?
For sure. Our next question is going back to the is insulin a hormone? I think I'm going to let you take this one, Victoria, because I'm not the best at explaining anything medically.
Super fair. So yes, it is a hormone. It's a protein hormone, which makes it a little different than sort of like the typical hormones you might think of, like testosterone, which is a fatty hormone. But basically, insulin works to help glucose get into your cells. And if you ever feel like nerding out on this, send us a message and I'm happy to talk to you about all the details. But for this, I'm going to keep it simple. Without insulin present and working properly, glucose essentially gets locked out of our cells. And so it gets stuck outside our cells, and our cells are hungry and they're not being fed. And this is because no sugar can get in. The extra sugar that hangs out around the cells and can't get in ends up going into our blood and our pee and pretty much everywhere else, except where it can be used to fuel the cells. And so insulin, for me, when I inject insulin through my pump, it essentially goes to all my cells and it works like a little key in all the locks and it lets glucose in so that my cells aren't starving anymore. And it is a hormone.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people hear about diabetics and insulin and they automatically jump to the conclusion that insulin works as a cure for us, which was the next question we found. Is insulin a cure?
And it's definitely not. A cure literally means that you no longer have the disease. And so even with insulin and well-controlled sugars, personally, I could never stop taking my insulin and be healthy. Right now, this is a life sentence. And it's for sure manageable, but it's permanent. And I need insulin every single day, all day to manage it.
Yeah, and this leads into the next question we saw, which was, is insulin affordable? And I'll start this one off by saying that I personally think insulin should be 100% free based on the fact that if someone was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and they can't afford their insulin, they're going to die within a few days or less. It's essentially what we need to stay alive. But is insulin affordable right now? In the United States, I would say it is definitely not affordable to most people. And since there isn't a cure right now, I really ask that anyone who's trying to donate money towards diabetic causes puts their money toward nonprofits like T1 International, who are helping the diabetics that are struggling and dying right now by pushing for insulin affordability and transparency. Because as much as I would absolutely love a cure, and that is the end goal here, we need to keep the diabetics who are here right now alive, because a lot of them are dying because they can't afford their insulin.
Ultimately, no, insulin is not affordable. I agree with you there 100%. And I think that I also agree that a cure is a great idea. And I can unfortunately tell you that we've been looking for a cure for diabetes or type 1 diabetes for a lot of years instead of making things affordable for diabetics. And I think that that's just sort of a mismanagement. Like you were saying, like it's more important to sort of help the quality of life of diabetics versus going forward and trying to find a cure for something that ultimately probably has a lot of different causes that are going to need a lot of different cures to treat the whole picture. And even in Canada, honestly, like it's way more affordable for insulin than it is in the United States. But I would argue that it's still not affordable for a lot of people who don't have adequate health coverage here. It's a shame when we have this really cheap to produce drug that is just highly overpriced.
Definitely. And I think there's actually a big link here to our next question. What do diabetics die from? And unfortunately, a lot of diabetics are dying from not being able to afford the supplies they need, specifically insulin.
Exactly. And the acute response to that is that diabetics go into diabetic ketoacidosis and die. But the long-term effects of that are an increased risk of having heart attacks, of increased risk of infection, things like people losing limbs because they don't have their nerves and they don't have adequate blood supply, so they get infections and have to have their leg amputated, for example, people dying from strokes, people ending up in kidney failure, needing dialysis or kidney transplants, or just dying. Those are all really quite common, well-known side effects of poorly controlled diabetes, which stems from people not being able to afford their insulin or just not being able to take it adequately.
Yeah, and I think another reason that I didn't think about a lot growing up, but now I think about all the time, is dying from low blood sugars in the middle of the night. That's another big one.
It's a huge one, and it's so scary. That's the reason why I'm sure we both have Dexcoms, but that's a big reason why I got one, because those alarms in the middle of the night let me sleep soundly.
Yes, 100%. I am so grateful for my Dexcom being able to wake up in the middle of the night if my alarm goes off, or if I sleep through it, having other people that can follow along and wake up. It's a really great piece of technology. All right, so I think this episode's getting pretty long at this point. I think we'll wrap things up with one more question, hopefully one that's a little more lighthearted, and that is, what do diabetics' feet look like?
This is such a great question.
I mean, I'd like to think I'm doing all right so far, but check up on your feet. Like I've mentioned in other episodes, I have known people to lose their legs due to complications from diabetes. Definitely not something to mess around with.
Absolutely. I feel like I could give a check your feet speech at the end of every episode and it would be important and well taken. My feet also look great for now, and with good diabetic control, they should look good forever. So sort of the deal with this, like I think it's just important to tell people what the deal is that your feet typically take about 10 years of poor diabetic control before you get nerve and blood vessel damage that can lead to things like those infections and ulcers that are those big scary things for me, because I worry about amputation, like you were talking about, Gianna. But it is a lot of time of sort of cumulative damage before you start getting the, I guess, before you're likelihood of developing those conditions sort of increases. And I think it's important to, wherever you're at in your diabetic control, just realize that you do have the power to take control of things and improve them. But I will say you need to check your feet every day, in between your toes, even if they don't hurt. Just take a look at them, see what's going on, see if you have any sores or any calluses or damage. It's so important so that you get ample time so that you can treat things before they become infected to the point that they need amputation.
Exactly. It is so important as a diabetic to take care of your feet.
Check your feet.
Yes. Anyways, I think we're going to move forward now to our weekly goals. We've had a little over a week with this one, so I'm going to need some refreshing, Victoria. What was your goal last week and how did it go?
I was successful at my goal. So it was to have a nice Thanksgiving dinner, and I definitely did. And I also spent some time learning how to draw a brain. So stay tuned to see my bad attempts on Insta. And now I'm working on drawing a map of the USA, which is actually really hard, but it was inspired by this election insanity.
I've definitely spent every 5 minutes refreshing the election results. It's been really scary and stressful here for sure, but I am excited to see your drawings. Those sound really fun.
Me too. And yeah, I don't envy any Americans right now. Certainly more Canadian privilege. So how did your goal go?
So my goal was to carb count for a full day straight. I didn't end up doing that. I ended up carb counting a little bit on different days, not consistently one. And it definitely helped in regards to being more aware of what I was eating, which is something I think I mentioned in the last episode. But I definitely underestimated the hit it would put on my ego in regards to serving sizes, types of foods I was eating. I thought it kind of motivate me to be healthy, but I guess I'm just not there yet because I was just feeling bad about myself. I was eating way more than the serving sizes. I wasn't measuring the food out. Maybe this is part of the process and I just have to kind of get past that one initial hump first, but it was hard. And I also didn't realize how many foods don't actually list out their nutrition facts. If you're someone like me who's buying food out a lot, you really have to do the research on your own to figure out how many carbs are in that product. You have to go online or use one of your carb counting books, hope that the food is measured the same, and then go from there.
Yeah, I feel that. I eat a lot of like hospital cafeteria food, and it's like there aren't portions, right? They just like give you whatever they're going to give you. Sometimes it's like they give you a reasonable amount of fries and like a burger, and then other times they give you like 6 pounds of pasta. And my problem is always like, I don't know how much I'm going to eat. So carb counting is tough. But I think what you're doing with like carb counting a little bit each and every day is awesome because you actually build more skills that way. And the one thing I'll say about carb counting is it gets easier as you do it more because you learn how many carbs are in things. A website that I find really helpful for carb counting is MyFitnessPal because it's user entered. So you have to be a little bit careful because people like just us are entering things and it's not always perfectly accurate, but it can give you a good idea. And like, I just try to find like a cup or a tablespoon or something that I can sort of picture in my mind how much like volume that is and see how many carbs is in it.
Ooh, I love that. I will definitely check that out. Thank you for that. You actually hit on another point I forgot about, which was not finishing the food you give insulin for. I've talked before about how with an insulin pump, you can suspend your insulin. So if you take extra, it doesn't feel like it should matter as much. But I found that my insulin on board, I guess, just wasn't accurate enough because I was still having those lows if I didn't finish the food that I had already dosed for.
Yeah, that happens to me probably every other day at least. It's the biggest problem I run into, especially with my schedule. And when I have a lunch break, sometimes it's only 30 minutes and sometimes I dose and try to wait and then I run out of time to eat or something like that. It is really a common phenomenon and I end up then having to chase that low all afternoon after lunch. Honestly, I would say that I'm low more often after I eat than if I just don't eat because my basal's really solid. But when I eat lunch, I often will miscalculate or just not be able to finish and then be low.
It's so annoying.
So annoying. Yeah. So I think that that's great that you've been doing that. And I think that it will eventually feel easier and you'll still run into problems because I think that that's inevitable with diabetes.
Oh, no doubt.
So this time my goal is to go for a nice walk this weekend. So like I've definitely not been keeping up with walking over the last 6 weeks with the weather changing and with my like, it's just been a whole different schedule with psychiatry and I'm not walking as much as I was when I was on internal medicine. But I do like my body feels better when I walk and when I'm more active. And I really enjoy just like the walk in the air and being outside. And it's supposed to like snow like crazy and rain tomorrow. So I'm hoping to go today.
I have been dying to go on a walk. I really want to take advantage of the weather in New Jersey right now. It's so nice here. I know you said it's going to snow by you, but I definitely, even today, maybe I want to try to get outside and go for a walk myself. I think mentally it can help so much and it also has physical bonuses. So that's awesome.
It'll be fun. I actually really like the first big snowstorm of the year, and this seems like it'll be really blizzardy, and it's on Sunday, and we can just stay home and relax and keep warm.
That sounds amazing.
So what's your goal this week?
So for this week, my goal is to bring lunch to work for at least one day. I've been buying food every single shift, and not only is it hurting my wallet, but it's also just really bad food. I'm eating personal pizzas, hot pretzels. These are all really high carb foods, and they're all just really greasy. The types of food that are going to drain you for the rest of your shift, and they're not the types of food you should be eating if you're someone who's trying to lose weight, which I currently am. Buying is quicker and easier because I'm busy, but it's just not working out for me when I think about it long term.
That's super fair. I also actually buy lunch a lot. Some of it's paid for, just like when we work call and things like that. So obviously I'll eat it there. But like, I'm obsessed with the chili from the coffee shop at the hospital. And I'm sure it's really not great for me, but it's so good. Anyway, I've also been trying to bring more food from home. And like, Carlin's been really helpful, like helping me package it and then bring it. But even that's hard for me to dose for, and it sort of takes longer. Like, it's faster for me to just buy something than it is for me to go upstairs, warm it up, dose for it, eat it. Anyway, I love your goal and I believe in you. You're gonna do it.
Well, thank you.
So with that, I think that we're gonna finish off this part one of our fill in the blank about diabetes episode.
And before we sign off, we did just want to mention that we designed 3 diabetic themed stickers in celebration of Diabetes Awareness Month. You can find them all on our Instagram @T1Talks, and it'll walk you through how to order too. You just gotta click on our highlights. So please go show us some support, and we really hope you enjoy the stickers.
I love them. And Gianna, where is your juice box?
A question I ask myself nearly every day.
Stay tuned for part 2, and we'll catch you then.
Until next episode.